Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another RightStream broadcast. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I want to thank you for joining me today, wherever you are in the world. I know I've been away for the past couple of weeks, so it's really nice to be back here behind the Blog Talk Radio microphone. And for those of you who don't know, I am an independent author, blogger, social media marketer, and the founder of the RightStream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio. And if you haven't listened to our other two hosts, I definitely want to put a plug in for them right now before we get to today's guest. On Sundays, tune in to Just Believe with host Lisa Tarvez. Lisa is a holistic health practitioner, and she interviews a variety of interesting people in the health and wellness field, self-growth, personal motivation, spirituality. Very fascinating program every Sunday here on the RightStream Radio Network, Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez, and that airs at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And then on Mondays, we have Military Monday with host, author, military historian John D. Gresham. And John always has interesting people in the realm of the military who have a vast amount of knowledge and expertise on all things pertaining to the United States military and military history. So he airs every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, RightStream Tuesday with me. It goes live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. I'm happy to be back on the air after a short break. I'm ready to go, and I'm back here today with a fabulous guest who I'm going to introduce here in just a moment. But I wanted to also announce some fabulous news for the network. We have a new show that's going to be broadcasting starting on August 28th, and it's going to air on Wednesday evenings. It's called the Family Power Hour with Dr. Billy Eisenberg and Sheena B. Wise. Dr. Billy is a licensed psychologist, and Sheena Wise is a family law practitioner. They are both based in South Florida, and they are going to bring years of expertise to the program. And it's going to be a call-in show where callers, listeners are going to be encouraged to call in, kind of like Frasier, if any of you ever watched Frasier in the 90s and the early 2000s, kind of a call-in show like that, where the ladies are willing to help with all sorts of family conflicts and relationship problems and dispense any kind of advice you might be seeking. So I'm really looking forward to this program. I know these two women personally, and they're excellent at what they do. And they will be going live on the RightStream Radio Network on the Family Power Hour beginning Wednesday night, August 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And as I get further details, I will be sure to post it on my blog. And please check out my blog, DariaDiGiovanni.com, for all of the latest RightStream updates, book reviews, commentary, and all kinds of interesting things, I hope. All kinds of things that I hope you'll at least find interesting. Okay, well, today's guest, I am absolutely thrilled to have on the program. His name is Rodney Page, and he is an author of a political thriller called Powers Not Delegated. And before I go ahead and bring him on the line here, I want to read from a book review from his website. And this was written by Susan Bradford, and it's dated October 2012. And she writes, "Author trumps Obama and Soros in Powers Not Delegated." By now, most people sense that something is amiss with the Obama administration. Many are waking up to the fact that President Barack Obama is a Marxist who has surrounded himself with radicals intent upon imposing their socialist vision onto the United States, whether the citizens are on board or not. They are also nervous that sinister puppeteer, billionaire George Soros, continues to work his magic on the president, pulling his strings through his vast financial war chest and political clout while drawing from his endless cash reserves to destabilize the United States. While Obama proceeds to transform the country, inflicting serious damage on the nation's financial viability, its democratic structures, and the free market, the electorate feels powerless to reverse the trend towards collectivism. What if Obama wins re-election? Is our country doomed? Not so fast, writes Rodney Page. Page, who has served in senior management positions and provided consultation for startups and Fortune 50 firms, has recently written a book, Powers Not Delegated. He charts a path that will allow the people to take back their country. The book dramatizes Obama's rise to power, from his obscure origins to his promising start as President of the United States, incorporating his campaign against Senator John McCain to Soros' manipulation of him, except that the names have been changed to protect the guilty. Half of the fun of this book, which is as engrossing as an Irving Stone novel, is trying to figure out which political figure Page is writing about, but he captures the essence of each character beautifully, from Senator John McCain, character Clint Garman's desperation to become president, and Obama, character Ben Thorpe's narcissism and lack of experience, to Rahm Emanuel, embodied in character Victor Sherman's thuggery. In a purely fictional work, which cuts devastatingly close to the truth, Page dramatizes Obama's rise to power, from his obscure origins to his promising start as President of the United States. Quote, "It was election night, and elation filled the hotel suite," he writes. Ben Thorpe basked in the glow of victory. The outcome of the election had not been in doubt for months. For Thorpe, watching his opponent's concession speech had only confirmed the obvious. His entourage, when listening to it, hooted with joy and took a few last disrespectful shots at Clint Garman, the defeated Republican. His self-admiration was cut short by an interruption by his closest advisor, Victor Sherman, Thorpe's soon-to-be chief of staff. Once Thorpe assumes power, the story takes a turn for the worse. Kind of like real life, huh? The Thorpe administration effectively exploited the momentum of the election and Thorpe's personal popularity to change domestic policy, he writes. It relentlessly increased its influence and, in some cases, control of key U.S. industries. Under the guise of saving the economy, the federal government gained control of the banking, investment, insurance, and mortgage industries. Two-thirds of the U.S.-owned automotive industry became effectively owned and managed by the government. Further, the central planners in D.C. were targeting the healthcare, energy, and pharmaceutical segments for a similar fate. While Thorpe ushers socialism into the United States and explodes the national debt, Isidore Krakos, the character based on George Soros, finagled in the background, with Page capturing the billionaire's pathology for power with delicious precision. The tale is a cautionary one. The story, quote, melds historical fact and fiction to illustrate how misguided, corrupt, and evil individuals and government institutions have the capacity to irreparably harm our republic, he writes. Only an informed electorate and courageous leaders who are grounded in fundamental constitutional values stand between a government that is by and for the people or one bent on tyranny. Page reminds the reader of the 10th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, which states that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, unquote. Has Thorpe, a constitutional lawyer, forgotten this? Well, on that note, I'm going to go ahead and welcome to Rightstream Tuesday author Rodney Page so we can discuss this further. Good afternoon, Rodney.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I am so excited to have you on, particularly as a writer of political fiction, because I really believe, and I want to get your thoughts on this as we move through the interview, but I really believe that culture drives politics, as Andrew Breitbart was famous for saying, you know, culture is upstream from politics, and that by writing fictional works that are based on reality, we stand a better chance of sort of getting through to those people who may not be paying as close attention as you and I. So welcome, Rodney, and I want to just start by giving you an opportunity to introduce yourself before we get into the book.
Oh, happy to. And thanks, by the way, to Susan for that review. I appreciate you reading that, and she was quite gracious in offering it. I was in business and industry for over 40 years in a variety of capacities along the way, but always had an interest in writing. In 2005, I wrote a nonfiction business book, and I think stimulated by the turn of political events after the 2008 election, I fulfilled a kind of a long postponed desire to write fiction. And that's a very short explanation, I suppose, but that brought me to the book and to writing the book, and it was probably a two-year labor in frustration and love to get it put together and finally to market. But I'm gratified it did make it to market. Many don't. And I agree with you that however we choose to reach those who may not be political junkies, I think it's to the benefit of all that we can do so.
Oh, absolutely. And, I've talked about this with the conservative fiction panel a couple of weeks ago, Rodney. I want to get your take on it. It's that, you know, we lost control of the narrative, and that's something that the left has been very patient about, you know, by taking over American institutions, and it's alluded to in her review of your book. But they were very patient in infiltrating, for example, the educational system, pop culture, and media. And while most constitution-loving Americans were busy working and being productive and going to church and raising families, you know, the rug was being pulled out from underneath of us. And one of the things, you know, the conservative fiction panel is trying to do is, you know, they're trying to take back the messaging because, you know, the GOP is certainly not going to do it. So I wanted to get your take on that and what your thoughts on that were.
First of all, I completely agree with you, and you articulate it very similarly to what I have over the years. Is I got out of college in the late 60s and kind of pursued the track you describe. And things started looking funky 20, 30 years later, and said, what in the world have I not been paying attention to? And I can testify personally, without any specific details, that in the process of getting the book to market, the bias in the literary industry is amazing. They're concentrated in New York, and this is not meant to be a broad blanket statement, but it was quite evident in my process of where their political heads were And it presented a bit of an obstacle at times for I think, a conservative writer. So, first of all, I agree with your premise that things, people went to sleep and didn't pay attention, certainly in my generation, for 20 or 30 years and woke up one morning wondering what in the world's happened. And I think most observers certainly would agree with you that the academic, journalistic, and the literary markets are dominated by folks who think whose philosophy is on the left. How do we take it back? You know, I it's going to be a challenge. I am eternally optimistic, even though some days it's a chore to be that way. But I just believe that people of the thoughts we have on the conservative side of the agenda are very, very frustrated now, but becoming more active in whatever their fields of endeavor are. In my case, I happen to write a book, but whether it's the church, the political party, whatever it is, I think activism, certainly positive activism, I don't mean anything other than that, is going to be required collectively by all of us to try to turn this dismal ship around right now.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I spoke about this with some of my activist friends several months ago, and we kind of said, we figured that it could get so overwhelming because there are so many fires to put out, in a sense.
I understand.
Yeah, so, well, Rodney, let me ask you this. What do you think about, because this is the approach I'm sort of taking with the cultural aspect. She and I talked, and I said, you know, maybe we ought to just focus in on, like, one major thing that we can tackle. And in your case, and in my case, I think it's the cultural, the writing aspect. Do you think that's good advice? I mean, what would you recommend for concerned citizens who just kind of feel overwhelmed and think, oh, my gosh, what can I do?
Well, first of all, I feel their frustration. Barely a day goes by that you don't turn on the computer, read a few headlines, and feel absolutely overwhelmed. I think that's the word you use. It's a all-frontal assault in all aspects of our culture, and you're exactly right. Which one do you pick to be concerned about when all of them concern you? I think the only way to deal with it, and I'm not sure I've mastered the way to deal with it. In fact, I'd be less than honest if I said that I had, but is to try to understand that a lot of it is temporary and reversible. Maybe long-term reversible and not tomorrow, and try not to get too emotionally down. And then no matter what your endeavor is, where you have contacts, where your network, personal network resides, where you have knowledge, where you have experience, you know, pick one or two to learn about in detail. Learn the details of that particular point that's infuriating you that day. It may or may not be real. It may be propaganda from one source or another, and if you dig a little deeper, maybe it's not as bad as you think it is. But find two or three that kind of match your experience, background, and interests. Dig into it, and I think from that, you'll probably self-identify what measures an individual can take personally to try to maintain their mental health as well as
right.
Some for the good.
Yeah, and it seems that, you know, kind of starting locally in their own communities is a great way to go about it.
Well, I think it has to be. That's, you know, hand in glove with how the country was founded, with local power, local political power and local rulemaking and lawmaking power. And, of course, we know what's happened since, you know, Woodrow Wilson and a little bit before. We've morphed into something in terms of the republic that was never envisioned. And the ultimate answer, and though this is rather philosophical and at a 10,000-foot level, is that local, in all in all ways you can define local in terms of politics, the culture, the religion, everything. It's got to start there. I don't think you can leap to the top and change 100 years of a direction of the federal government we may not agree with. It's entrenched, and
yeah.
It will. I don't, you know, short of something you read about novels that I didn't write about, which is really ridiculous stuff. You know, you're not going to change it at the top, and you're going to have to just get people at the bottom to begin taking the power back. That's obviously a nonviolent, patient, and I think with a broad set of initiatives that in a generation or two perhaps can get us back to where we need to be.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. Now, Rodney, I want to talk about your book for a little bit because you mentioned, you know, the publishers, and most of them are based in New York. What was that experience like, and is your book traditionally published? And just tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I was new to the process, even though I wrote a business book, as I mentioned, almost 10 years ago. That was just a unique situation where a friend of a friend knew an agent, and it worked out very rapidly, and I didn't have to really market the book real hard. But I initially went the traditional route, and if you read websites, and I did a bit of self-elimination too. If you read a website of a literary agent who says, you know, we're looking for progressive-oriented fiction or whatever the term may be, well, you know, there's no real need to go there. And then there were quite a few of them. Even though it's been a shakeout in the market generally, there are a lot fewer agents today than there were several years ago. So I was, as any author, most authors experience, I've had my share of rejection, and more than my share, I thought, but that's just part of the game.
Yeah.
If you're thin-skinned and don't want people to just gush over what a wonderful writer you are, don't become a writer, because it's not going to happen. I ultimately identified a small independent publisher, and a great little outfit. I'll give them a plug here. It's BQB, Boy, Quotient Boy Publishing. Had a lot of discussions with them, and their model is a cost-sharing model. It's not self-publishing, and it's not traditional. It essentially, the publisher and the author share the cost of going to market and then share in the proceeds. So that's how I got to market. I'm working on some other things, and we'll be reapproaching the traditional market in the relatively near future. So I learned a lot, and I still don't understand the industry, and it's in a tremendous state of change with electronic publishing, et cetera. You know, anybody that's got a computer can get a book published for almost nothing these days, and it's kind of turned the industry upside down. But I'm fortunate that I think personally with the turmoil, because it created entrepreneurs like the BQB people who presented a very professional alternative and a way to go to market with a quality product and with some quality support.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think overall technology has been a positive for the publishing industry and certainly for authors. But, you know, as we talked about with the conservative fiction panel, it also means that we have to be pretty impeccable with our editing and still, you know, put out the best product possible. Now, this publishing company sounds very interesting. I had not heard of that type of model before, Rodney. And you know, since even if you're traditionally published these days, it still seems that it's incumbent upon the author to do a lot of their own marketing. I mean, you know, unless you're – and I think even if you are a very well-known name, there's still a lot of marketing to be done on the part of the author. So it sounds like this was a great sort of, you know, alternative or a great sort of middle ground between self-publishing, you know, on your own and going the traditional route. So what are some of the things that you've done – with your company to market the book?
First of all, let me, before I answer that, just affirm what you just said. The BQB model, and I'm sure there are others that do it, offer all the professionalism of the traditional book publishing models in terms of editing, graphics design, et cetera, et cetera. And it does, I think, fill a huge gap, and they're very selective. It's similar to the traditional route. You submit a manuscript, and obviously they have a dog in the fight, and they want to publish things that will sell, since they share in the revenues and royalties. So I just wanted to clear that up. What did I do? You're exactly right, and regarding marketing and the fact that unless you're a John Grisham or someone like that, any publisher through any channel is not going to throw a whole lot of marketing dollars behind the promotion. I was relatively uneducated on social media when I began this process, but in my business career, I was at marketing my whole life, and I understand if the dogs don't eat the dog food, it doesn't matter how good we think the dog food is. So I went into it with an appreciation of marketing and the fact that everybody had to do whatever they could. So I became very well acquainted with particularly Twitter and Facebook, and I'm certainly not a technical expert on either, but it was a prime ground for me, and still is, to market the book. I also very diligently, and it takes a lot of time, identified target markets, and let me give you an example. For my book, it would be commonsensical to conclude that Tea Party organizations would be good prospects for the theme of the book. And if you're diligent and you have the time and can basically develop lists on the internet when you're half asleep after having done it 8 or 10 hours, you can identify quite a few specific targets that are members of organizations that would be supportive of the book. And I did that. And I put together a newsletter type format for one could unsubscribe if they wanted to. But I sent out quite a few individual emails to email addresses that I identified just through hours and heartache to get the list together. I would add this. Of course, the publisher did the usual things in terms of press releases, et cetera, and we worked very closely together in drafting the press releases and customizing them for whatever channel they were destined to be sent. And I would encourage any author out there working with a third party of any sort to help market their book to create a very open and honest dialogue. And you know your book, and an author knows his or her book better than anyone else. Sometimes they know it too well, and the outside perspective really helps. But usually the confluence of what the author thinks and wants to do and say with what a informed third party wants to do and say, you meld that together, you get a pretty effective marketing message.
Yeah, and you know when as I was listening to you, Rodney, I was thinking that old adage, and it's so true, is know your audience. So, I mean, that certainly comes into play. Now, since you mentioned Twitter and Facebook, Rodney, let us know how we can follow you on Twitter and the name of your Facebook page.
Sure, if you just go on Facebook and search Rodney Page, you'll get there. And on Twitter, I'm at @powersnot. DELGTD.
DELGTD. Okay.
Right. They didn't give me quite enough spaces to get it in accurately spelled.
Good old Twitter.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing on the side note. On the side note, Rodney, you know, with Twitter, I found, especially when there's a hashtag game going on, it really helps you to channel your creativity and be as expressive as possible in the using the fewest amount of words. So it's good. It's a good creative exercise, I think.
Oh, it is. It is, and sometimes it's quite frustrating because there's no way to do it in whatever it is, 140 characters. I mean, you learn the art of brevity. That's for sure.
Absolutely. So now, as far as the writing process for the book, obviously we know where you got your inspiration, but when did you start writing the book, Powers Not Delegated, and how long did it take you to complete it, as far as just writing it?
Wow. If you begin when I said I'm going to do it and sat down and started outlining, which is entirely another hour to talk about that process, but from the time the manuscript was finalized to go to the printer, it was approximately 2.5 years. And it was my first venture into fiction, so there were many, many, many iterations and reverses, of course, and improvements in the manuscript as I learned more and got some really valid feedback from a lot of people. So that I'm not suggesting that's the norm, but that was my experience for the first novel.
Now, was it challenging, because it was based on, real-life people and current events and the current administration, and, I mean, to use the pun, things are coming at us, fast and furious with this administration. It seems to be, every day there's some new scandal or some new outrage. How did that figure into your writing the novel? I mean, did you find yourself having to kind of go back and incorporate something new that took place in real life?
Luckily not. It is a novel, and it's reflective of the current administration. However, there are, I believe, a lot of entertaining, completely fictional themes in the book in terms of terrorist attacks, blackmail of a Supreme Court justice, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the blessing of writing a novel and not writing nonfiction. You don't have to tell the truth all the time. You don't have to be completely accurate. So the stage was set basically at the end of, within a few months of the election. I think it was clear, as Susan pointed out in her comments, that we pretty much early sensed what was going on, the direction it was going to be taken. So that's a long answer to a short question, but no, since I was not trying to, keep it up to date with every scandal, I never finished it, as you can well imagine. But once the philosophical tone was set, it was pretty much set. And then the overlay of the, I think, more entertaining plots and purely fictional plots had a sound foundation.
You know, Rodney, what has been the reaction to your book?
I think generally favorable. When you publish a book, you have to understand, or you're going to be real disappointed, that from a rate of return standpoint, if you want to look at it from a profitability standpoint, you have to consider the life of the book. And if you don't sell 500,000 copies in the first 2 weeks, and want to go out and kill yourself, you're going to be dead pretty quick. So momentum's building, and the timeliness of the book, particularly, I guess this is the only benefit I can think of, but particularly with Obama's reelection, the timeliness and the relative nature of the book, or the politics, or its relative nature to reality, continues. So it's building. You wish you had $30,000 to spend on marketing. It would be great to see one's book, on Drudge pop up how many million people a day look at it. But that's just out of the reach of most people. So you just have to be patient. You just have to grind. And as long as the trend line of sales is going up, I think you've got to be satisfied. So the marketing never ends. As long as the book's in print or available, you know, in e-form, and it's relevant and there are potential customers, it's a product that has a long shelf life, and you have to realize that and not get bored with marketing and say, I'm tired of this, I'm going to go do something else. So you just got to stick with it.
Yeah, and especially, you know, with social media and this age of new technology, you're absolutely right. I mean, it never ends, and there's always, you can always attract new people, you know, to your book and you know, to your website. And yeah, so it has to be a never-ending process. I'm certainly familiar with that. So, Rodney, let me ask you this. Did you make the book, speaking of new technology, is the book available in all the popular formats?
It is, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it's so funny. I mean, and this is another marketing piece, but I want to get your opinion on this. I mean, personally, myself, I'm very old-fashioned. I like to hold the book in my hand. But on the other hand, when you're marketing a book, you know, I realize it's important. You know, when I published mine 5 years ago, to make it available in Kindle, for example, because they're very popular and people like them. And I certainly can understand the appeal of a Kindle, even though I'm the kind of person that likes to highlight and write things in the book. So just kind of on a personal note, just curious, what do you have a preference, and how do you feel about all these new e-formats?
Well, I learned a lot going through the process. Thankfully, the publisher knew a hell of a lot more about it than I did, which allowed us to get on Kindle and Barnes & Noble and Kobo and other strange names I had never heard of. So that they took up the slack of my lack of background and experience in that area and got it done. Specifically to your question, I think I like both formats depending on what I'm reading and where I'm reading it. If it's a nonfiction or I'm doing some research, I, like you, prefer to have a piece of paper. You can mark and scribble and dog-ear the page and put a bookmarker and a piece of paper and blah, blah, blah. But if it's for pure entertainment and convenience, I love my Kindle. So that's a good political equivocation. You know, I love all the babies, I suppose. But I think they both have their advantages.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree with that. Now, Rodney, in terms of blogging, I mean, do you maintain a blog? And if you do, how often do you post on there? And what kinds of things do you do to engage your readers?
Yes, I do have a blog. And it's a political commentary blog. Luckily, I've been picked up by Bernie Goldberg, and he reprints or reposts my blog. But to be completely honest with you, it seems I write them when I find or read a particularly disturbing piece, a piece of news, something just beyond the pale, and I make an attempt to make my point in writing with a good deal of humor and cynicism, because there's a lot to laugh at, and you need to laugh these days. And it keeps, as you mentioned, it's another avenue to keep your name in front of the public. It's mental health for me. It's a lot different type of writing than writing fiction, because here you are dealing with fact, and so many, this may be an overstatement, many bloggers and many writers on our side just whine. And there's a lot to whine about, but I try to at least creatively and entertainingly whine and make fun of the opposition, you know, while hopefully communicating a point.
Yeah, and again, and I think it's so important, because if you can be funny and bring an important point out through humor, you're going to attract more people, too. You know, maybe people who aren't paying as close attention. So, I mean, that's an excellent point that you bring out. You want to be, I mean, as scary as and outrageous as some of the things are that are taking place, and my gosh, I could point to about a million of them Right. Now, when you're writing about it, I think that's important to maintain your sense of humor and try to be as engaging as possible while you inform people. Because, again, it's very easy to get overwhelmed because we're being hit from all directions with so much. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, Ronnie, but I could cry some days when I look at what's going on in our culture. And so I think that that's so important. And plus, you know, on a marketing perspective, too, in terms of the book, as you said, you want to get your name out there, but you don't want it always constantly to be about, well, buy my book, buy my book, buy my book. You want to engage people on all these other issues, like you said, and in your case, political. So I think that's great. Now, where can we read your blog? What is your blog address?
Okay. It is www.blog.powersnotdelegated.com.
Okay. Wonderful. So I will definitely check that out. I'm going to bookmark that. And Ronnie, I wanted to get your take on something else because, you know, earlier in the show I mentioned messaging and that, you know, we all are responsible to kind of take back the messaging and, you know, we can't wait around for a political party to do it. You know, I made this point with somebody on another program. I think it was with the Conservative Fiction panel, and I said, you know, it's a shame that, you know, these quote-unquote big money donors, you know, that are on the right side of the aisle, they keep wasting their money, in my opinion, on the Republican Party when they could be really supporting, you know, these excellent top-notch bloggers and authors like you who are really trying to engage the culture. What do you think about that? I mean, what are your thoughts?
It may be a bit cynical, but I don't think they're doing anything that they don't intend to do. I was in business for 40 years, as I said earlier, and if there's a capitalist among us, I'm one of them. So I want to make that very clear before I make the following comment. But I pay more and more attention. It's just very clear that a lot of the big money comes from big business, very big business. And in the end, they're going to look after their shareholders. And I think many have concluded their shareholders benefit more if they're plugged into the power structure, and I mean particularly in Washington. So I'm not a conspiratorialist completely yet, maybe, that the big business is completely in bed with big government, but if they're not in bed with them, you know, they're getting hot and heavy in the den before they move there, and therefore I'm not sure they're mistakenly or misguidingly doing anything. I think they know their goals, and I think they're taking the steps to try to achieve the goals as they think they should for their shareholders.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I could point to a concrete example, and I mean, I'm not quite a conspiratorialist yet, but you know, facts are facts. I mean, we can look at this whole amnesty debacle currently raging, mm-hmm. and we see that the Chamber of Commerce supports it, and big business supports it, and it's really bad for everyday people like you and me, and it's completely subverts the rule of law and, you know, puts our nation at further risk. I mean, for me, and I'm letting you jump in here, but I mean, I just want to say this. I mean, I find it absolutely disgraceful that we're about to mark the 12th anniversary of 9/11 and our borders are still porous, wide open. And, you know, so go ahead, Rodney. Let me, you know, tell us what you see, how you feel about that.
Well, it indeed is distressing, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is primarily made up of very large industry, very, very large companies. And I'm not sure it's as simple for many of them as they want a continuing source of cheap labor. I think that's not a particularly intellectual explanation. But these CEOs, you know, and let's be honest, they got a deal with the Justice Department. They got to deal with OSHA. They got to deal with the FTC. They got, or if they're in broadcasting, they've got to deal with the FCC. So the big businesses have to deal with government regulatory policy and legislative policy. And you know, we all gripe about the lobbyists, but that's what they try to impact, the lobbyists rather, or what regulations or or put in play that can affect their business, what laws are passed that can affect their business. And they're going to do, I'm being repetitive here a bit, I suppose, but they're going to do those things that will keep the EPA off their back. I mean, I think it's very pragmatic. It's philosophically enraging because I would think many of these senior managers, senior executives, get on the golf course, and many of them are probably personally conservative from a political standpoint, but they say, you know, if we don't keep the EPA out of our backyard, they can make our life miserable. So, you know, you can argue emotionally, as which we all tend to do, that these folks have abandoned us, blah, 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 whatever it might be. But I think on the other hand, to give it some reasonable, you know, balance, they're looking out for shareholders. And if the EPA can shut down their plant, they've got to take that sort of thing into consideration.
Well, and I think I know a lot of grassroots activists who would say, you know, we need to get rid of things like the EPA in the first place that are unconstitutional. But, I mean, I definitely understand what you're saying, and it certainly explains their thought process. But, you know, what do you make of that, Rodney, just as a political activist? I mean, in terms of all of this massive government bureaucracy that we're dealing with, you know, if you had the power to get in there and start cutting back on some of these things, where would you start?
Wow, didn't anticipate that question. I wouldn't dare. Who is the worst villain? You know, I don't know. I think in terms of the impact and the corruption we've seen in the last 60 days and the power, the police power, you got to look at the IRS, but if you look at the IRS, you've got to look at a whole new tax structure. But it's, I've been honestly quite depressed the last several months because, since we're talking about the IRS, had the things we are continuing to discover, had they happened, I think, even 10 years ago, the country, many in the country, many in the media, general media, I think would have been particularly outraged. And in fact, fast forward to today, and it's like, oh, well, it's just another one of these things because something else has come up the next day. But I'm kind of squirming from your question, but, you know, if I had the magic wand, I would change the tax code, which by definition would get rid of the IRS.
Yeah, well, I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. And I was thinking, you know, in terms of your book, Power's Not Delegated, and talking about states' rights, you know, one of the things, in my opinion, and love to get your take on this, we could abolish the Department of Education and return, you know, we were talking about local control before, and that's really what the founders intended. I would return education to the states, which is where it really belongs. I mean, we have this raging fight going on with Common Core, and one of my friends in Florida is actively involved in that state and pushing back against it. And I think that's a prime example of something that could be eliminated at the federal level.
I think it is a very good example, but I in my opinion, kind of with a broader view, I think we're seeing a popularly entitled, you know, the conflict between the red and blue states. And I think you're seeing in many, quote-unquote, red states, a much more aggressive posture by the state-level politicians and beginning to assert some of their authority under our federalist system. And I don't want to be too melodramatic. I don't want to be melodramatic at all, but just pure practically speaking, you're seeing some state governors and legislatures reassert their power. And in quote-unquote blue states, you're seeing them, those legislatures and governors run as far away from asserting power except to replicate what the federal government does. So where I'm going with that discussion, I don't know where it winds up, but it seems from a state government model as it relates to the federal, how they relate to the federal government, you've got some states going 100 miles an hour in one direction and other states going 100 miles an hour in the other. And you wonder, where does that end? I don't know that there is an end, except you're seeing two models of federalism develop simultaneously, and you wonder, can that coexist in the future?
Well, gosh, that's such a good point. And I think it also gets back to, to me, my observation is that the left just appeals to pure emotion. Nothing is really based on fact, because if they based anything on fact, people could look at history and say, well, you know what, that model doesn't work. Whether we're talking about, taking statism to an extreme, whether we're talking about communism, which killed millions of people, or Nazism, fascism, so they can't really, they can't really deal in the facts. And so I think that's why it's so important that we engage the culture. And it's not going to turn around overnight because, as you said, this has been a 100-year process. But was it Stalin himself who talked about, the power of the cinema, and that's really where you get people? I think the real problem lies within human nature itself and people not being properly taught American history and having all of this appeal to their emotion. I see the left as appealing to sort of the basis of human nature, to laziness, to victimhood, to the belief that you can't do anything on your own, that you need the government to help you. And I see them doing that, and to me, it's so evil and it's so corrupt because you're basically telling people they're powerless in order to expand your own power. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm in a complete agreement. The deterioration, the primary and secondary education in this 30 years when I was apparently on Mars or something, it's coming to roost. And how do you change that? I don't know that it can be changed retroactively. You can only hopefully change for the future. But I would add a comment to what you said. I think liberalism does appeal to the less informed, not the stupid, but the less informed to accomplish some of the things you've mentioned. But I think the leadership on the left, and you always follow the money and follow the power. They know exactly what they're doing. They're not stupid. They're very, very bright people. And with government centralization comes control not only of the things perhaps the government should have some involvement with. Let's just give them a break here and say, no, we don't think the environment should be polluted to the point that fish die. Who would support that? So I think there's a role for regulatory oversight at some level. But when we're now to the level of, if not legislating, suggesting strongly what we eat, drink, smoke, drive, and almost anything else, then they're not doing that just for fun. They're doing that because they know ultimately they'll get votes, and with votes comes power, and with power comes money for them and their friends and the courts that help them get to where they get to. So I'm in complete agreement, to summarize, I'm in complete agreement with you regarding many voters and some that don't vote, that just have chosen not to pay attention, don't want to pay attention, to care less. But to characterize the left solely as emotionally driven, I think is not given enough credit for their guile and cunning.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, that's their tactic, is to appeal to emotion in the true believers or the mindless foot soldiers, as Evan Sayet calls them. And I don't mean that with disrespect, but I just think there's so many people who just totally buy into what they say because, you know, let's face it, it's pretty subtle, the indoctrination. I mean, it's in pop culture. If you ever watch a sitcom, I mean, I don't really watch television, but, you know, other people, when they, it's infiltrated every aspect of our life. I mean, everything has become political, even the NFL. And so you have the low information voter crowd who are not, you know, not suggesting that they're stupid people. I'm suggesting that they're not, as in, they're not politically informed, and they're easy targets for these emotional appeals by the left, and they know that you're right. They know exactly what they're doing, and it doesn't matter if the propaganda is, it's not true. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's just, it's when you appeal on pure emotion in other people to expand your own power, that's all that's necessary. You know, because they've taken over pop culture and academia and public education. So yeah, I mean, it's, and you're right. I mean, we're not going to, you can't fix it retroactively. I agree with that. I think we can only just make the changes now, and this didn't happen overnight, and it's certainly not gonna get fixed overnight. Rodney, where can people buy your book? I can't believe we're winding down the last 5 minutes of the interview, and I want to make sure that we let our listeners know where they can purchase Powers Not Delegated.
Sure. It's at all the normal places. Both the print and electronic versions are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. So all the usual places. It hasn't, as the majority of books don't ever achieve, is widespread bookstore distribution, but it's available through all bookstores to order, even though it may not be available on the shelf.
Excellent. Okay, and again, your Twitter account is at Powers Not Delegated, but it's DELGDD, correct?
G-Tom-David. GTD.
Correct. Okay, excellent. I'm going to follow you as soon as we end this interview. And people can find you on Facebook at Rodney Page. Now, is that a fan page, Rodney?
Yeah, the page itself is Powers Not Delegated, but if you search Rodney Page, both you can access them, both my page where I do most of my activity currently, as well as the books page through that. Just search Rodney Page. That will do it.
Excellent. Okay, great. And I think, Rodney, you know, just I don't know that I discussed this with you, but I've launched another internet radio network called the WeBuiltThatNetwork.com, and I'm thinking we got to bring you on as a guest on our Inalienable Right program. So I will be in touch with you about that, because certainly your book, that audience would definitely be very receptive to your book. But I really want to thank you so much for joining me today. Do you have any parting words for the audience before we sign off here?
It always gets darker before the dawn.
Yep,
that's so, about as inspirational as I can muster today.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, and it's true. And, you know, people just have to keep the faith and keep doing those little things that we talked about, and certainly maintain a sense of humor. I think that's so important. And faith, you know, prayer, definitely powerful. I just believe, and let me just say this too, I mean, I really think that so much of what's going on is a spiritual battle. I mean, you could look at what just happened with the Texas legislature, and thank God they were able to pass that 20. But, you know, just watching that all play out and the Zimmerman trial and how that was just agenda-driven from the beginning, I mean, you can certainly see, I can be this dramatic, you can certainly see the good versus evil duking it out in our society, and I can understand how people can get discouraged, but we have to stay strong.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely.
So, well, Rodney, I want to thank you so much for joining me on RightStream today. Good luck with the book. Everyone, please go to powersnotdelegated.com and check out Rodney's book. And, Rodney, I'll be in touch with bringing you on our other program pretty soon.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it and look forward to chatting with you later.
Okay, have a great day.
You too.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and that is going to wrap up RightStream Tuesday for today, July 16th, 2013. This is your host, Daria Ann. To listen to all of the archives, please go to blogtalkradio.com/RightStream and check out Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez, Military Monday with John D. Gresham, RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann, and coming soon, on Wednesday night, the Family Power Hour with Dr. Billy Eisenberg and Sheena B. Wise. For now, this is Daria Ann signing off for this week's Write Stream. Have a great week, everybody, and stay in the flow of creativity.